From Massachusetts to Montana, Oklahoma to Ohio, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, as congressional Democrats plan for trillions in new spending, they're advancing a wide array of tax hikes to partially pay for it. Joel Griffith from the Heritage Foundation is here with details. President Biden is mandating federal workers and employees at large companies receive the COVID-19 vaccine. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story on the economic impact. Congress is using a $700 billion gimmick to make it look like their massive new spending bill won't hike taxes on the middle class. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine will explain. And as the Biden administration pushes mandatory COVID-19 vaccinations, there's still no waiver for those who have had the virus and now have natural immunity. Dr. Paul Kangor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. The Biden administration and congressional Democrats are pushing for a $3.5 trillion spending bill and over $1 trillion in infrastructure spending. Now they've released plans for major tax hikes to partially pay for all that spending. To learn details, we turn to Joel Griffith. Joel is a research fellow with the Roe Institute at the Heritage Foundation. Joel, welcome to American Radio Journal. Joel, before we get into the specific taxes, what is it that Democrats are proposing to spend, and what is the spend number they're looking at?
Thank you for having me. Well, it's hard to get our mind around these numbers, but the plan the Biden administration has proposed is $6.4 trillion worth of spending over the next several years, over the next 10 years. If you start crunching those numbers down, it is mind-boggling. That's $20,000 per second for an entire decade. If you're talking about per family, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars per family of four coming 10 years. So this is monumental. $6.4 trillion divided by 300 million people, you get very close to $100,000 per family of four. It's amazing. So it's a lot of money. And if you look at this in terms of prior spending packages of programs over the years, this is more money in inflation-adjusted dollars than we spent in the entirety of World War II when we were fighting both Imperial Japan and Nazi Germany and Fascist Italy. So this is an incredible amount of money, and they're planning to fund this by raising taxes and by borrowing. About two-thirds of this would come from tax hikes and about a third from more deficit spending.
Let's focus in now on the proposed tax hikes because, again, the numbers here are almost impossible to get your head around. They are so large. So what type of tax hikes, tax increases, new taxes are being proposed by Democrats in order to fund this massive new spending?
This proposal would undo much of the tax cuts that we saw in 2017. And as a reminder, those tax cuts were a big benefit both to businesses, also to families. A typical family in Florida, for instance, is saving $1,300 per year in tax cuts. The most important part of the tax cuts in 2017 were making our businesses more competitive. We had really some of the highest business taxes in the industrialized world. And in an age where capital and labor and business flows from border to border, it's important that we be competitive. Well, if you look at the results over the last several years, it was really paying off. We saw 12,000 factories start come to the United States. We saw family income increasing. We saw business income increasing. It's because we became much more competitive. Well, this tax plan would raise business taxes to 28%. And in fact, the rate that they're proposing to raise the taxes on is so high, it would be higher here than in communist China. Think about that. We're supposed to be a free country, and our business taxes are proposed to be higher than communist China, higher than across the European Union, higher than nearly every one of our competitors. And unless we think for a second that only those that are wealthy or business owners are going to be paying for this, yes, they're going to be paying. We're all going to be paying, though. A study after study demonstrates that when you hike taxes on businesses, there's simply less capital to be invested in new opportunities, in new equipment, in new technology. And For those of us of more modest means, and for people that may be in blue-collar jobs especially, it's those investments in technology and equipment that allow them to earn more to take home to their families. So this is going to eat away at that. And we also know in many cases, businesses, well, just about every case, businesses try to also pass along these increases in cost to consumers. They have to if they want to stay in business. And for many of us, nearly all of us that are dealing with higher prices thanks to inflation, this is only going to compound the problem when the Biden administration, if they actually are able to pass through these enormous tax hikes on businesses.
You did reference the fact that we had these tax cuts under the Trump administration. And actually, if you go back in history, all the way to the Coolidge administration, the Kennedy administration, the Reagan administration, we have seen what Art Laufer actually memorialized in his famous Laufer curve, that you lower tax rates, you get more tax revenue. So this projection that these tax hikes are going to bring in more revenue, is that likely to happen, or could this actually cause revenue to go down because, as you've just said, we're taking away economic opportunity?
Well, this is likely to backfire, even if this does result in more dollars for the government. And it might result in more dollars collected for the government. This is likely to result in trillions of dollars collected for the government that will have a direct impact on how our lives will be lived. Because every dollar that's confiscated from a business, that's a $1 less that's available to give to shareholders. It's a dollar less that's available to buy equipment, to invest in technology, to pursue other opportunities. And there's something else that's important with this plan as well, to be hiking some of the capital gains may be impacted too. The money that you pay when you sell an ownership stake in a business. And when you have a period of rising inflation like we see now, those gains are often illusory because the dollar that you receive in your pocket is actually worth a lot less than the dollar that you invested thanks to inflation. So that'll deter investment opportunities as well. And you do raise a good point. There are some instances in which the taxes can be raised so high, you actually result in less government revenue. Think about if you were to have a 100% tax rate versus a 90% tax rate. Well, when you raise it to that 100%, there's going to be no incentive for people to produce. And so you would actually raise less with 100% tax rate than you would with 90%. In this case, the government is very likely to see more revenue. But that isn't what we should be going for here. We shouldn't be looking at maximizing government revenue. We need to be looking at how do we maximize opportunity for people. And the way to maximize opportunity for people is to actually make it easier for businesses to get started, easier for businesses to reinvest their money. We all end up better off as a result.
We have been talking with Joel Griffith. Joel is a research fellow at the Rowe Institute at the Heritage Foundation. And Joel, tell us a little bit about Heritage, and this obviously a very complex subject. So where can folks go to read more about it?
You can go to heritage.org. And Heritage Foundation is an organization committed to the ideas that make our land a land of opportunity, the ideas of limited government and federalism and free markets. We try to do our best to ensure that we preserve a nation where civil society and opportunity can flourish.
And your website at Heritage?
Heritage.org.
Joel Griffith from the Heritage Foundation. Joel, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has been, as he always does, keeping an eye on things happening in the nation's capital for us. And we welcome him back. Scott, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me back, Loman.
A couple of things this past week and also queued up for the week ahead. Before we get into some of the budgetary issues here, Scott, President Biden, after having said he wouldn't mandate the COVID-19 vaccine, has instead shifted gears and is trying to impose that vaccine in a number of areas. Tell us a bit about what the president is requiring, and there appears to be significant pushback in a number of states.
There's still roughly 80 to 100 million Americans that chose not to receive the vaccine. And what Biden is trying to do is mandate any business that has more than 100 employees or any entity that receives federal money, any federal employees, requiring those employees to receive a vaccine or be tested at least once a week by the employer. And so he's going through the Labor Department and threatening massive fines against the American people for making these health decisions. In many instances, you're going to see business require the vaccination because that's what this executive order is calling for. And I think you're going to see a pretty major fall off when it comes to labor participation if this executive order is allowed to go forward and not ruled unconstitutional by the courts and thus taken away its power. What are the other side effects in terms of the economy? Obviously, when labor decreases, you'll also see a decrease in supply for a lot of areas of the economy. And that can certainly, once again, fracture and threaten the health of what I think is a very sick economy right now. We're looking at a major reconciliation package this next week here in the House of Representatives to spend as much as $3.5 trillion. We've already spent $1.9 trillion on the Biden stimulus earlier this year. They're also trying to do that $1.2 trillion infrastructure package. So, and then you know about the trillions and trillions of dollars that we spent in 2020 directly trying to maintain a economy that was on the brink. So we're in this situation here. Inflation, labor, and supply shortages. You know, I think that the economy is certainly very, very volatile. The markets look okay right now, but everybody needs to keep an eye on what the economic impact would be if the Biden executive order was permitted to go forward.
You speak of reconciliation, Scott. Can you, for our audience, tell us a little bit more about that process and how it is being used to skirt particularly the rules of the Senate?
What we're going to see next week is consideration of the bill in the House of Representatives. And, you know, the House of Representatives is the federal entity that's determined by proportional representation. So a state has, obviously, congressional districts, and that's what a representative is serving on behalf. And then the senators are representing the state interests. So when reconciliation goes through, it will be a partisan exercise in the House, but that we've seen a lot of partisan exercises. Pelosi doesn't usually chase Republican votes. And so the difference is that when a reconciliation bill moves over to the Senate from the House, it has what's known as privilege, and it can be passed with a simple majority because of sort of these arcane budgetary rules and restrictions limiting what kind of legislation can go through. It's still signed into law by the president, unlike a budget resolution, but it is something that can be taken up with a simple majority vote in the Senate. And so we have a 50-50 Senate right now, and that means that the vice president can cast a tie-breaking vote. Right now, we think Pelosi wants to do $3.5 trillion of spending, as much as $3 trillion in tax increases. And the way that I kind of look at things, if any of that makes it over to the Senate, because Pelosi only has a handful of votes that she could lose in the House as well, right? She can only lose three votes. If she loses a fourth, she can't pass the bill. And so when it makes it over to the Senate, how much is it reduced in size and scope and cost? And the Byrd rule is another procedure that the Senate goes through to determine whether the reconciliation legislation maintains that certain privilege to be voted on through a simple majority. And so it can't change like major policies, right? You're not supposed to put like a minimum wage increase in a reconciliation bill. You shouldn't have legislation to do climate change, right? Like those are policy shifts, not just a budget and spending exercise. But they do test the limits. And so I think that you'll see a lot of the bill that ends up passing the House, I think a lot of that will come out in the Senate. And it'll be significantly reduced. And so we still need to remember how big a trillion or a $2 trillion package is, even if it comes down from $3.5 trillion.
Concurrent with all this, the federal debt limit is something that's about to be hit. Mitch McConnell, Scott, is holding rather firm that Democrats are going to have to do this on their own. So is this a situation where we could actually hit that debt limit?
Extraordinary measures are anticipated to be totally exhausted by the middle of October, according to our Treasury Secretary, Janet Yellen. And so McConnell is trying to hold firm, saying, why should we help the Democrats increase the debt limit? ultimately, I do predict still that the Democrats will force those votes on the continuing resolution and tell the American people that Republicans are voting to default on our debt obligations. I think if the votes happen early enough, and meaning not so close to September 30th, that's a difficult narrative for the Democrats to maintain. But if they force votes at the sort of 11th hour, Republicans will probably panic, and how many will cave, right? So it's certainly it's sort of the September thriller in Washington, D.C., to witness what's going on in these major legislative packages that really will determine the fiscal health of America over the next several months.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, we typically end with you telling us a little bit about the club, so why don't we do that now?
The Club for Growth is a membership organization focused on economic freedom. If your listeners want to check us out, you can do so at clubforgrowth.org, and you can actually become a member for free.
Thank you, Scott. Talk to you next week.
All right. Thank you.
Congress is playing fiscal games with the child tax credit to make it look like taxes won't be raised on the middle class to fund their $3.5 trillion spending spree. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine has details.
A central part of President Joe Biden's plan to hike federal spending by about $3.5 trillion over the next decade is a promise that middle-class Americans won't face a tax increase. But a new analysis of the bill that Congress is crafting that would actually put together the specifics of Biden's plan and pass it into law shows that individuals earning as little as $30,000 annually could face a tax increase as soon as 2027. But actually, that whole thing is just sort of a trick of the light. It's a deception. It's a gimmick that is being used by Congress to make the overall cost of the bill look lower than it really is. Yes, there's a $700 billion gimmick at the center of Biden's tax plan. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. This week, as I said, we're taking a closer look at this $700 billion gimmick at the center of Biden's tax plan. And if you've been with us through the program, you've already heard quite a bit about the tax plan and about the specifics, which are now trickling out of Congress this week. So we're going to zero in on one particular part of the bill, specifically the sort of shenanigans that Congress is playing with the child tax credit. This is somewhat complicated, though, so we're going to take it slow. And let's start kind of with the big picture here. While the bill does not raise income taxes on anyone earning less than $200,000 annually in the immediate future, the next few years, Americans earning, as I said before, as little as $30,000 could face a tax hike by 2027 under Biden's plan. And all of that is according to an analysis published this week by the Joint Committee on Taxation, a nonpartisan number crunching agency that is housed within Congress that acts sort of as Congress's official fiscal scorekeeper. The culprit for that future tax increase is, again, as I said before, the expanded child tax credit. The House plan would extend the expanded child tax credit through 2025. And it's really more accurate to say that the culprit for that future tax increase is Congress's unwillingness to address the full cost of that tax credit in this bill. By promising to raise taxes later, effectively what Democrats are doing is they're manufacturing an extra $700 billion in fake savings that will likely never materialize. In general, the House Democrats' plan does shift the tax burden towards wealthier Americans in the next few years. And that's largely because Biden's proposal relies primarily on hiking income tax rates for high earners and raising the capital gains rate, the rate that is paid on capital gains, rather, which is applied to investment earnings. But when you skip ahead a few years, you look at 2027 and beyond, things look quite different. By then, the changes that House Democrats are now proposing would result in higher taxes across the board for nearly all Americans, even those making as little as $30,000 a year. But the shift in that tax burden is primarily caused by the expiration of the newly expanded child tax credit. Now, to understand exactly what that means, you have to think back to what Congress did in March. As part of the COVID-19 relief bill that was passed in March, Congress approved a one-year increase to the child tax credit. It went from $2,000 per child annually to $3,600 per child under the age of six and $3,000 for children between the ages of 6 and 17. Instead of being a tax credit that you claim at the end of the year on your taxes, it's now delivered as a monthly payment of either $300 per child or $250 per child, depending on the age of your kids. In the reconciliation bill, Democrats are now proposing to maintain the expanded tax credit through 2025. We should also point out that the tax credit isn't really a tax credit at all, but really a direct subsidy. We still call it the child tax credit, but at this point it's been changed so that it is paid out even if recipients have no income and even if they owe no federal taxes. It's not just a credit against taxes that you owe, but rather a direct payment of money from the Treasury straight to people who have children. And it is quite expensive. The Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget estimates that the child tax credit costs about $110 billion annually. When you extend it to 2025, as Democrats are trying to do, it will cost about $450 billion. But making it permanent would mean that it costs about $1.1 trillion over the next 10 years, over the next decade. And that time frame, that 10-year window, is really important because Democrats want to use the reconciliation process in the Senate to pass this bill. And when you try to use the reconciliation process, there are a bunch of rules that govern exactly what can go into a bill that can pass that way, that can just pass the Senate with a simple majority rather than requiring the 60-vote threshold that other legislation does. And one of those requirements is that you cannot have a major impact on the federal deficit over the next 10 years projected forward, according to the Joint Committee on Taxation. So you have to offset every dollar of new spending that you want to have. And if you're proposing a program that's going to cost $1.1 trillion instead of one that's going to cost $450 billion, well, that's a much larger amount of money that you have to offset. But by setting the expanded tax credit to expire just 4 years from now, Democrats are able to ignore roughly $700 billion in future costs that would have to be offset in order to use the reconciliation process if they were going to extend the tax credit permanently. So, long story short here, it's a gimmick. And it's a gimmick that, yes, Republicans have also used when trying to push major tax policy changes through the reconciliation system. The Trump tax cuts were passed using some of these exact same gimmicks to route around future costs and promise future tax increases that probably won't actually happen. But as a result of this gimmick, the Joint Committee on Taxation's estimates for fiscal year 2027 don't include the child tax credit, and that's why it looks like taxes will go up for a lot of middle-income families a few years from now. So this is a clever game. Democrats are able to wave away objections about those future tax increases because they'll say, well, of course Congress will extend the tax credit before we get to that point. But at the same time, they don't have to account for those future costs of the inevitable extension of that tax credit in this bill that they want to pass in the next few weeks. Lawmakers are quite literally crafting legislation, not in pursuit of the best policy for the country, but in order to avoid the very barriers that they previously put in place to limit deficit spending through the reconciliation process. Gaming the system is no way to produce the best outcomes, and that's especially true for today's kids, the people who are ostensibly supposed to benefit from this child tax credit policy, because it's going to be them who have to pay the costs of this in the long run. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Bame. Check out more of our coverage of Biden's tax bill and everything else that Congress is working on right now at Reason.com, and you can catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
As more and more employers require their employees to have the COVID-19 vaccine, little thought is given to exempting those who have already had the virus and now possess natural immunity. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College talks about it on this American Radio Journal commentary.
In my previous commentary, I expressed my frustration at vax fanatics who insist that every single American get vaccinated, including the estimated 120 million, according to the CDC, who already had COVID and thus have natural immunity. Those Americans need not be forcibly vaccinated against their will. And at the least, why not seek from them proof of antibodies rather than proof of vaccination? Alas, is there any good news amid the vax hysteria? Are there any signs of hope for those of us with natural immunity who plead not to be jabbed with mRNA-based vaccines that are not traditional vaccines? Yes, I'm happy to report one case. At George Mason University Law School, Professor Todd Zawicki pleaded not to be forced to get a vaccine in light of the salient fact that he has natural immunity from COVID-19. His university had insisted that all students, faculty, and staff get vaccinated, threatening disciplinary action that, quote, could include unpaid leave or possible loss of employment, unquote. Of course, George Mason is far from unusual. Sadly, it's typical of many, if not most, universities, some of which, like Indiana University in Bloomington, have become high-profile legal cases where the student plaintiffs lost. As classes started nationwide this semester, some colleges expelled students who weren't vaccinated. The University of Virginia disenrolled over 200 students for not complying with its mandate. At George Mason, Professor Zawicki was represented by a group called the New Civil Liberties Alliance, which argued, quote, for Professor Zawicki, who has recovered from COVID-19 and acquired robust natural immunity, it is not only medically unnecessary to undergo a vaccination procedure at the current time, but doing so also would create a great risk of harm to him, unquote. Zawicki himself said this, George Mason is forcing me to undergo an unnecessary and potentially risky medical procedure. Multiple clinical studies have shown that natural immunity provides at least as much protection against reinfection as the most effective vaccines, and unquestionably more protection than less effective vaccines from China and elsewhere that the university policy approves of. Clinical studies have also shown that receiving vaccination after recovering from COVID prevents an elevated risk of side effects. This, said Professor Zawicki, is an important health matter that should be determined by my doctor and me, not forced on me by university policymakers who have no familiarity with my personal medical history, unquote. Yes, Professor Zawicki, it is indeed absurd. Millions of Americans are being subjected to the fiats of faceless employers who have anointed themselves the roles of unimpeachable medical ethical tribunals. Who are these authoritative experts? Truly, what are their credentials to judge? Zawicki's attorneys note that, quote, shockingly, unquote, the university will accept any vaccine approved by the World Health Organization, not just FDA-approved vaccines. This means it will accept many vaccines that have proven to be quite inferior. Yep, precisely that is happening at strange workplaces nationwide. It's a farce. And yet, Zawicki's case has a silver lining. George Mason University ultimately relented. It granted the professor a medical exemption. Finally, a victory for natural immunity and for sanity. Says Zawicki, I'm gratified. I speak for tens of millions of Americans in the same circumstances I'm in, and I call on leaders across the country to develop humane and science-based approaches as opposed to one-size-fits-all policies, unquote. Actually, Professor, you speak for probably 100 million Americans. Sadly, many of them, especially students starting back at college this fall, will not get the perfectly reasonable accommodation that Professor Zawicki received. The vax fanatics, they're like a mob, and one can't reason with a mob. One can, however, seek legal assistance, and that's an option that those with natural immunity must be willing to pursue. The mad vaxxers have left them no other option. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including our newest affiliate, KSAK-FM in Walnut, California. Welcome to our new listeners in the Golden State. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.